Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Maurice Ruit. Let's get into the news of today. And the first story we're going to talk about is that Julius Malema is not getting a visa for going to the UK. Now, the EFF has launched a blistering attack on the United Kingdom's government. Malema was scheduled to address the 11th annual Cambridge Africa Together conference, an event hosted by the African Society of Cambridge University. The EFF, in response to a letter from the UK government saying he would not get his visa in time to be able to go and have a look, speak at this event, said, I'm going to read some of it because the rhetoric is such as can only come from an EFF statement. Quote, in what can only be described as an administratively orchestrated ban on the president of the EFF, the British High Commission has actively delayed the processing and approval of the visa application by the Commander-in-Chief and has sent a letter of regret that it will not be processed in time for the address at Cambridge University, which is scheduled for this weekend. This letter of regret was sent today when the president was set to depart to the UK following a confirmation that the visa will be processed this afternoon. The EFF went on to say, the EFF is well aware that this is a reflection of the attitude of imperialism against the Commander-in-Chief and the EFF, who has been a strong and critical voice against the United Kingdom for its role in the atrocities of colonialism, particularly the role in the British monarchy in the slave trade, its role in sustaining the genocide of the Palestinian people by Israel, and the continued resistance by Britain regarding the paying of reparations to victims of colonial conquest. He went on to say the UK was suppressing academic freedom and that the EFF also wanted to reaffirm their statement on the death of Queen Elizabeth and remind the bureaucracy in the UK that their monarchy still owes the world a huge debt for the crimes they committed against humanity through colonialism. The UK's Home Office had a spokesperson who said that they regretted they would not be able to process the application in time. Saying that this was due to the number of bank holidays, that's public holidays in the UK recently, which had basically created a backlog in visa applications. Spokesperson for the Home Office in the UK said, quote, I recognize that this will be deeply disappointing, especially as the delegation applied in advance and paid for some priority service. I would like to assure you I've taken a personal interest in this issue and have been in regular communication with relevant Home Office officials over the last week. I'm afraid, though, I have no means of intervening in the decision-making process itself, which is solely a matter for the Home Office. We have secured an agreement from Home Office colleagues that should the delegation choose to do so, the Home Office will fully refund all application fees. So, Maurice, do you think the EFF was banned, or do you think this was just a whoopsie?
Well, firstly, I think it's quite funny that the EFF sees red like that when they are saying, we are opposed to the UK and everything it stands for, and we're really upset now that they don't want to give us a visa to go to that country. I mean, they said nasty things about Queen Elizabeth when she died, and there's obviously things you can criticize the UK for, but, you know, if you're going to criticize the government, you don't have an automatic right to go to another country. Any country has a right of refusal to let anybody in for whatever reason, actually. We must also remember that Julius Malema was banned from going to Botswana and to going to Zambia when both those bans have been lifted. He's allowed to go to those countries now, but he was banned from going to those two countries. And they are obviously not countries that were going around and colonizing and doing all kinds of horrible things like the British were doing. I don't remember seeing these kind of vitriolic statements coming from Julius Malema about not being able to go to Botswana or Zambia. But if you look at the statement from the British High Commission, I think all it comes down to is that simply the EFF or Julius Malema didn't apply in time. And now now they're trying to cover up their own administrative bungles. But I think it's also quite telling that that the British say that they'll refund Julius Malema's visa application fee. When that doesn't happen with ordinary people, when you apply for a visa to the UK, they make it very clear that your visa application fee is non-refundable, whether you get your visa or not. So I think it tells you something that they prepared to refund Julius Malema, and it was probably quite a lot of money. A normal UK visa costs you about 3,000 rand, I think. If you've got a priority one, it's probably close to 10 grand. So it's probably quite a lot of money, but you're not in the as I say, in the terms and conditions when you apply for the visa, they tell you very explicitly that it's a non-refundable fee. So yeah, I think overall, this is pretty much a storm in a teacup, and I just think it's an administrative bungle by the EFF, I think. But I'm sure probably the British government's, I mean, it's probably also a nice excuse not to let somebody like Julius Malema into their country.
Yeah, so, you know, the British are not afraid to deny visa applications to of countries that they don't like or individuals they don't like. Then they've done that before. A couple, you know, quite often in recent years, they have denied visa applications from anyone representing the Russian government, for example, to enter the UK. So, you know, the British response here really kind of does suggest that this was more down to British bureaucracy being, shall we say, not incredibly efficient. And I understand the frustration with that. But an orchestrated ban on the movements of Julius Malema, this is not. This is not them saying, you're not allowed to come here and you can never come back. This basically is like, whoops, we didn't get the visa ready in time. And, you know, there is, I think, some political incentive for the British government to maybe have right now, especially when they're, you know, Malema's been in the sights of the US administration. And I think the British announced a trade deal with the US today, I think I'm correct in saying. So maybe there was some political incentive for them to say, well, maybe not today. Right now is a bad time for it. But even then, I think that's kind of weak because, you know, they've already announced it and he's going to speak.
And I think like, overestimated Julius Malema's importance, I think. You know, obviously, yes. I think he is somebody who's, like, I do think there probably are some eyes from the US on him, but I don't think he's really such an important figure for the White House at the moment.
I think the bottom line is if the British really did want to deny him a visa, they would have said so, rather than just saying we didn't process it in time.
Exactly. And if they want to be on the US's side with this whole thing, they would have said we're not letting him in because he's a race baiter and he wants to kill the whites in South Africa, whatever the case is. Yeah, and they didn't. Yeah, exactly. And I think this was just a case of British bureaucracy meeting EFF incompetence. And that's why Julius Malema didn't get his visa.
Indeed. Which is going to be very funny the next time he's asked to go and address some conference or something in at a British university and he gets his visa the next time and then, you know, he goes to denounce their colonialism and imperialism and how they're the most evil country on earth. It's also kind of funny just the sort of the EFF statement is like way overwritten. It's like every bad thing the British have been accused of, it's like, well, you know, they were involved in the Marmara Rebellion and the slave trade and this and that. And you're sort of like, man, like this is so sort of first year university student trying to impress girls. That's kind of like the impression one gets from it. But anyway, it's sort of a strange.
But also, they'll raise that kind of thing, but you won't hear them saying anything about Russian imperialist aggression, which is always quite interesting.
Yeah, and Chinese imperialist aggression, or indeed even Britain's role in stopping the slave trade, which is a whole other historical chapter that is complicated, but we don't have time to talk about now. But anyway, okay. Let us go on to our next topic, and this is the budget. The third go at the budget is promising to spend a lot on infrastructure and to focus on the great Operation Vulindlela. What is Operation Vulindlela? That is apparently President Ramaphosa's plan to reform South Africa's economy so that we get economic growth. Now, there's been a lot of talk about Operation Vulindlela, and a lot of the things talked about as the successes of Operation Vulindlela are allowing private electricity generation, which is a genuine policy success from the ANC government in recent years, of splitting out the transmission grid from Eskom, digitizing government, focusing on improving service delivery and administration, and the finance minister, Enoch Godongwana, has promised that as part of the next budget, in order to facilitate the goals of Operation Vulindlela, the government will spend up to R1 trillion in the medium term on various infrastructure projects. Marius, my take away from this is that that's in theory good. South Africa does need more infrastructure investment. Infrastructure investment is a genuine spending thing that can create economic returns. That's good with me. Problem is we have such levels of endemic corruption. We have these BEE premiums. We have all these layers of inefficiency on top, which is that, you know, spending R1 trillion is really not going to get you that far unless you address some of those issues in terms of getting your bang for the buck. And also you know, I agree. We should split the transmission network from ESCOM. The president's been promising it since 2019. It's taking a very long time to happen, and it's been very slow. I think there has been some progress on it recently, but this is kind of fiddling around the edges and not getting at the heart of the economic reforms we need to take place. What's your take on this?
Yeah, there's some good stuff. Like you say, infrastructure spending is one of the best ways to get economic growth going. And there's been very low levels of gross fixed capital formation in South Africa by both the government and the private sector. And if the government starts moving, then the kind of tailwind might pull the private sector into also to start investing in this kind of stuff. But as you say, this is pretty much tinkering at the edges. There's nothing about removing policies and laws that are actually growth destroying or growth retarding, things like NHI, the Expropriation Act, these new employment equity quotas and so on. And this all sounds all very nice in theory, but I think there's an argument to be made that Cyril Ramaphosa is the most radical and most pro-national democratic revolution president South Africa's had since 1994. I think he's certainly more radical than Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki, and actually even more radical than Jacob Zuma. Jacob Zuma was just liked to steal and hollowed out institutions. He didn't actually pass that many bad laws. Nothing like NHI was passed under his watch. Expropriation wasn't. You know, Employment Equity, we didn't have these very harsh fines and stuff coming out under the Zuma administration. These are all Ramaphosa policies. So while it all sounds very nice in theory, and this is a step in the right direction, if we do actually have a budget that is going for growth, but you know, it's a question of one step forward and two steps back. I think if you're going to get infrastructure spending going, but if you have other laws like NHI and expropriation and so on, you're not going to get people spending on infrastructure. That's part of the reason why private companies don't invest in fixed assets in South Africa, because it's very uncertain. You don't know if you go buy, say, if you're a big food company, agriculture, if you produce whatever, mealies, whatever. You don't know if you should go buy a farm that's going to produce more mealies, because what a property rights going to look like in South Africa in 2 or 3 years' time. You don't go invest 5 million rand, I don't know how much farm is, but say it's 10 million rand in a really big farm where you can do whatever. You don't want to go invest that because it's very uncertain. And you also, do you even want to expand with the kind of employment equity laws that are coming in?
And not just the sort of top level policy stuff, but the kind of functions of government. You know, are your crops safe from being stolen? Is your equipment safe from being stolen or vandalized? Are you going to be able to access services and things that you might need for stuff on your farm? I mean, you know, if you're having like a dairy or something, are you going to be able to get the requisite amounts of electricity? Those are all open questions which prevent that kind of fixed investment you're talking about. And that's the kind of real stuff. And sort of hand-waving in a way of saying, oh, we're improving service delivery. Well, you know, how are you going to do that? Are you going to end cater deployment, which prioritizes party affiliation over competence all over government? And if the answer is no, then you're not serious about improving service delivery.
Exactly. And we've seen how bad government actually is a real retardant to economic growth. I mean, there was the case of the Omar Rusk factory in somewhere in the Eastern Cape. And they actually had to move their factory because the roads from the factory to when they would go take it to wherever were so bad. By the time the Rusks got to Joburg or Cape Town or whatever, they were all broken because the roads were so bad and because the potholes and so on. So just really basic stuff like that, just retarring a road. But that stuff doesn't happen.
Right. You know, and spending it, if that trillion rand that you're spending that would in theory go to fixing that road is passed off to a cater here to do half the job and pocket the rest of the money, then, you know, you're not actually going to be solving the problem. So these are, I think, the deeper structural issues we need to get at rather than just saying, well, we're going to spend more on infrastructure. Well, that's easy and that's nice and everyone agrees with that. Everyone on the left and the right, pretty much, unless you're like a hardcore libertarian, thinks that we should spend more on infrastructure. But that's step one in what is a much more complicated process of reform. Still,
exactly,
as they say, could be worse. So we look forward to seeing what actually comes out in the next budget and whether it is a vast improvement over the last two. Let's move on to our last story. And this is a foreign story. We don't normally talk about these, but it's maybe worth a little bit of a mention. Two nuclear armed countries are at blows with each other. These being India and Pakistan. who this was triggered after in the disputed region of Kashmir in northern India or kind of eastern Pakistan. There was a terrorist attack where a large number of tourists were killed. India said that the group responsible was being funded and supported by the Pakistani government and promised retaliation. That retaliation came the other night when India launched significant missile attacks in across parts of Pakistan. Pakistan has vowed to return fire at some point of their choose. And in the disputed region of Kashmir itself, there has been significant shelling of each other and some fighting. Marius, this is not an unusual story. India and Pakistan have many, many times come to blows, particularly over Kashmir. But there are some signs that this one could be a bit more serious than some of previous conflicts. What's your take on this?
Yeah, it seems that things are escalating there. And there's been lots of animosity between India and Pakistan, for, as you say, for a number of years. I think it's been worse in recent times since the BJP, which is a kind of Hindu nationalist party, has governed India since, I think, it's 2009. And a lot of people actually, there are factions in the BJP which people would characterize as fascist or a Hindu supremacist. And a lot of them have quite a lot of influence in the BJP. And one thing we must also remember is that both these countries are nuclear-armed states. So it's all pretty hairy. But it does seem that Pakistan, I think they don't really want to get into a full-scale conflict. I mean, there will be a lot of collateral damage, especially if, God forbid, nukes start flying around. But I think India is also much richer than Pakistan at the moment. Pakistan's also, it's got lots of internal problems. Its last democratically elected Prime Minister, Imran Khan, is still in jail. I think there's a lot of animosity and resentment towards the government in Pakistan at the moment. So, I mean, but often authoritarian governments do use clashes with outside powers to kind of ramp up support and so on internally. This happens all the time around the world. But I'm not sure if that'll happen this time. And I would be quite surprised if Pakistan really wants to ramp this up. I think in any long-term conflict, I think Pakistan will be the loser compared to India.
No, I think that's definitely right. And this is probably not good for either country. They've taken a whole bunch of quite nasty actions against each other. India suspended a water treaty that they've had for a very long time with Pakistan. Even through several of the last couple of conflicts with Pakistan, they haven't suspended this water treaty. And Pakistan is, you know, a very authoritarian, very unstable, very poverty-stricken country. And this is certainly not going to make any of those things any better. Anyway, something to keep an eye on. I personally think that while the conflict may escalate a bit, I don't think it's going to spiral into a full-fledged war. At least I hope it won't. I've been wrong about these things in the past, but it is definitely something we'll keep an eye on. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will see you all on the Daily Friend Show tomorrow. Cheers, everyone. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.